speaking about her Titanic ordeal. She was by now an elderly lady, but had been 7 years old when the ship floundered. There I was in the lifeboat watching the ship go down, and that's when I saw the other ship. But she never came to us. She became very emotional recalling the moment. She and her mother had been put into the lifeboat by her father, who had waved them off with a goodbye. "I shall see you very soon," he had said, smiling and reassuring us. We never saw him again. Eva Hart continued, choking back her tears, her voice cracking as the terrible episode was recreated once more in her memory. "For years they said I was wrong. Even at the inquiry they insisted Titanic went down in one piece. But I know there was a big explosion. I saw that ship break in half before she went under. I saw another ship, I know what I saw," she composed herself. The officer said, "Don't worry, the Californian is coming for us." Jade stopped the video abruptly. How could she know that? They couldn't even raise the Californian on the wireless. How did she even know that the Californian was in the area? That wasn't even mentioned in the investigations at all, Jade said, in disbelief. Mac was taken aback at the thought. Yeah, how would they have known that? Jade rustled through more of the investigating report. Second Officer Light Toller and a few others saw another ship. He thought it was coming to help, but when he tried to signal it, it sailed away, she read. Here, look at this. It says right here. Titanic's officers told several first-class passengers that the Californian was on its way. Mac was rapidly being drawn into the mystery that the questions held. And it was over an hour before they even started telling the passengers to get in the lifeboats. According to the official story, Thomas Andrews told Captain Smith within a few minutes that the ship would sink. Why didn't they send the first distress signal until over an hour after that? She questioned. They were interrupted by a knock at the door. Jade continued speaking to Mac, still on the roll. There are so many discrepancies here. The Californian was flashing a light for 2 hours at Titanic. But they never woke up their wireless operator to call and see why they weren't getting an answer. So what was the crew thinking? She said. Masters entered with Johns and Flynn as she continued. Then there's the mystery ship, the yellow funneled steamer. It was seen in the area, reported by the officers and crew of the Californian. It's never been explained. What do you think? Is that what Eva Hart was talking about? She looked up, not giving much attention to Masters and Johns. Yeah. The Italian saw it, Mac harped. Play him the tape. Johns quipped. What mystery ship? He was getting interested too. The mystery ship, the yellow funneled steamer? It was seen right there, near Titanic. The officers and crew of the Californian saw it. It's all here in the report. Near the time of the sinking, she was interrupted by Master's gruff tone. You're never going to be able to answer that, Masters said low. And insulting. His eyes stared hard at her and then to Johns, who encouraged her. It's in these survivors' testimonies. It's right here. Nobody asked anything about it. They didn't even follow up, she said. Bullshit, Masters said. This is testimony, she fumed. Play the tape, Mac urged. Masters held his predictable stone wall. Ignoring Masters, Jade hit play on the tape and rolled some old, black and white footage of an interview with a, by then elderly, Italian man, Raimondo Vittel, who told his story in broken English. You'm loved a Titanic. She's so beautiful. I'm smoking the cigarette on deck. I see the yellow Amelika. She come straight to Titanic. She hit, bam, hit the front, then the yellow, she take off. Titanic no, hit it a iceberg. The yellow she hit a Titanic, bam, a bam from it a yellow. I see. She hit a Titanic. She not a stop. She put a lights to off. Titanic not hit a to iceberg. If I say a nothing like a all to others, my life is better, easy. I saw. I tell you. With a my own eyes, when I'm a young a man, the eyes are a very good. Jay turned off the tape and turned to look at Masters. That had to hit him. She looked for it in his eyes. But it wasn't there, only Master's cold blank stare. What had Jade thought? Why did she think Masters would get it, that he would come around? How badly she wanted him to. She could have loved him so easily, but his closed-off determination to defy anything that would open the conversation, to answer a few damn questions, was never there. She deserved some answers. She hated to be shut out like that. Why did he get to her like that? She couldn't stop thinking about it. He didn't even have to speak. It was all there in his eyes, his distant stare that locked her out. Why didn't the ship stop? They said there were two ships. Would that be the yellow steamer and the Californian? This guy is looking for attention. No doubt. Masters couldn't let her go down this path and ruin his whole operation. This can't be happening, he thought. Is that why you won't film that boat? She made sense and it hammered at him. What the hell made that hole, said Johns. It looks like an internal explosion, not damage from landing, Flynn guessed, before being cut off by Masters. I don't want to hear any of this. He snapped at them. That's not our mission. Johns was now intrigued. He wanted an answer. This is a credible venture, said Masters. Let me explain something so we're all clear. He was serious. He couldn't have been more to the point. We're sitting on top of the most profitable, most marketable piece of history. We put cameras down there and film every detail. We come back with a tour of Titanic. They get a first-class ticket to go anywhere on her they want, without disturbing Titanic. It's a gold mine. Video tours, without damage to Titanic. When that law is passed, no one will be able to go here. That's the idea. That'll make the difference. This is the last salvage of Titanic. He had wanted to rail into Jade, but it wasn't the time or place. It seemed they all had sided with her. He hadn't expected that. He hadn't expected any of this. Expeditions had their problems, but not these annoying side issues that pulled the focus off the task at hand. He stalked away angrily, muttering under his breath to himself. Jade was left there in the dust of his lingering wrath. Shooting frustration swept through her like fine misted crystal drops, forming her thoughts, wondering why can't he just answer a simple question? I got him, that dick, said Mac, pointing out that he had the camera on. The crew of the Californian saw the mystery ship. The Italian saw a yellow funneled steamer. She was bewildered. These were some points of interest that would be great for the documentary, but was she now supposed to keep silent? Jade was never one to be pushed. She took it as a personal challenge to prove her point. Although she did not yet know what that point was, she would not give in, not to Masters. She wanted his respect, not that she wanted to argue, but these questions deserved answers, intelligent answers, by people who had the expertise to find the answers. Masters has the equipment, she thought. He could take a look and disprove the hearsay and theories, because the evidence is right there, right below us. She knew that it had been proven that Titanic broke in two, disproving the British's claim that it went down in one piece. Other theories could be dispelled too. Why was she digging so hard? Why didn't she just go along with him? What was it about the whole thing that made her uncomfortable and curious? Did she want what Masters had, that fame and notoriety? Was this the ticket to it? A great documentary, not just a blasé, exposed her that he wanted. She saw that possibility. Was there any reason to risk this to make trouble? She could just film them, make a buck and move on, give Masters what he wanted. She knew herself well enough to admit it. Yeah, she did want a shot making a hell of a film. She had the subject to do it. As she saw it, Masters makes his film, I'll make mine. It was more gripping each minute. She had a ton of things that didn't add up. It was all intriguing. And just asking the questions was stirring things up even more. People had been kept quiet, records were missing, evidence not brought forward in the investigations, and then there were the testimonies, where witnesses seemed to give set answers. The yellow steamer, Eva Hart's not going to make that one up. That always stuck in her mind. The Californian not coming. Lightoller testifying what he heard about the vibration. Morgan setting up the New York investigations. Anyway she looked at it, it led to follow the money. Jade had it all whirling around in her brain. There was no way this was going to be some simple film on Masters' boring idea, when all this evidence, or at least unanswered questions, hung so heavy in the misty sea air. This was what Jade had been waiting for. This was stuff that people had passed over, or had they been paid to look the other way? This was the story she wanted to film. There were details about things that got glossed over, pushed under the rug, or covered with carpet. She had the means to put together the truth. If only she didn't have to fight Masters at every step, she could get his footage on what she wanted to film. Why was he so against it? Wasn't he curious? Her heart was pounding. It was the first time Jade felt like she really wanted to get in that sub and go down and film what she wanted. She was willing to risk all and get in that cramped, cold little bug-eyed container, if only she could make some the great point. What else seemed more logical than to know why the hull was twisted steel and where the yellow funneled steamer and the Californian fit in? Masters' theory of the official story didn't add up. It was more than interesting. Too much was unanswered and she couldn't let it go. The more Masters didn't want her to know, the more she wanted to know. She was good at digging deep. This was her job. She didn't want to make some video tour, showing how great Masters was. That's what he wanted. To be glorified on film. She wanted drama on camera, Masters going off on them, yelling at them, his mood, his temper, his aloof nature and his damn fixation on Titanic and the mystery that lay before her. All the mystery this grand dame held, that Masters seemed to want to avoid, only drew Jade in. Maybe she would just ruffle his feathers or maybe she should come to her senses and keep her job. Too many thoughts ran through her head. Why was Masters so removed and indifferent? Why did it bother her so that he was indifferent? She would question everything. There was a steamer, she thought as she played shots on the screen again. Chapter 18. Morgan's Yacht, New York, 1908. A blueprint of the proposed new dry dock that would accommodate the sister ships during their construction was lying on the table. Next to it was a large-scale, exclusive, ordnance survey map of Belfast, showing the land surrounding the existing confines of the Harland and Wolff shipyards. Morgan was now the proud owner of the White Star Line. His son Jack looked on. Carlyle, Lord Pirrie, and Ismay were in the study of the luxury yacht, to toast to the old man. This is where Morgan worked from. He brought the meetings to him. Of course, as we know, there is no dry dock big enough to house ships of this size, Ismay said to Pirrie. You will have to acquire these 14 acres here, to accommodate the first two ships to be built. The dock will have to be at least 11 stories high and that will not come cheaply, he said. Morgan sucked on his cigar. His brows, square and hard, gave a tough unreadable stance. That's going to cost. Harland and Wolfe want payment when the keel is up. That's 15,000 men that need to be paid, said Jack. I'll worry about that. Tell me about the design, the old man was eager. 16 watertight compartments all included, said Carlyle, proudly pointing at the blueprints before them. The ships will be designed to be as close to watertight as humanly possible. 16 watertight compartments separated by 15 watertight doors, mused Morgan thoughtfully. Yes, exactly, replied Carlyle. Sections can flood with water, but as they do so, the doors are closed automatically with the push of a switch and this will keep any flooding contained within the individual bulkhead. Morgan looked at the plans, proud of his bold venture. This is what I want. Beautiful, he told them. It was as much of a compliment as he was known to give, but still seductive. He pointed at the blueprints with his cigar firmly between his fore and middle finger, the leaves wound so perfectly, the ash held onto the burning amber even as Morgan thrust it about. They're class in themselves, he continued. I envision this new white star with elegant upper decks for the wealthy in the first class section, and yet, a third class accommodation hidden from view. What I'm counting on, gentlemen, what I want out of you, is to give me room for steerage. But surely you want to consider speed as the way of the future? Began Ismay, only to be cut short in full flow by the old man. No, Ismay, he said brusquely. Vacations. People are going to spend money on vacations simply for the sheer pleasure and experience of it. The rest are coming to America, buying tickets and steerage to become citizens. No one could ever accuse Morgan of not being a forward thinker, a visionary, despite his flaws. He then picked up the scale model of Olympic and stared at it lovingly, as one would a child. We shall forego speed in favor of passengers, lots of passengers. Lure them with luxury, he emphasized. Ships can always be faster. But no one will match Olympic's sheer luxury, the size. She'll carry thousands? The sureness was seen on his face as his words were heard. All one saw was the enthused look, with what he had in mind lingering in his eyes. Contemplating the fruition of all the dreams he held deep in his thoughts was his alone. As Morgan pointed with his cigar, his ash, long and heavy, finally cascaded in a large silver ashtray in a perfect burnt roll, holding its shape. You see, floating hotels can be extremely lucrative, he said. Jack knew the old man had always used his yacht as such. Now he was just accommodating the rest of the world. The old man had flourished well in business and in health, working and traveling on the sea. Morgan shared his futuristic idea. The aim is to form an impression in the passenger, to create a feeling and atmosphere as if they are in a hotel floating around the world, rather than a ship. Upon entering the decks and following into the interior, a passenger would feel at home like they were at an estate with all the comforts they would expect. At once they would seem to be entering the hall of some great property on shore, with every fine accoutrement. People will pay for that. The size will give it that feeling, while at the same time carrying such a load as the unseen steerage, it is a money-making prospect. You have overpaid for this thing. How are you going to afford to finish the ships? Asked Jack quietly. The old man stood, gazing out the huge porthole window, his back now turned to the others, even as he spoke. I'm in for the long-term investment. Chapter 19 Atlantic Siren, 1993. She scoured through her tapes to hear more from Titanic survivors relating their heart-rending experiences. Eva Hart said, I saw a ship that was so close. We headed towards it, but it just ignored us and steamed off into the night. Another, now elderly, lady named Carolyn, with a tear down her cheek, recalled the tragic event. The ship turned off its lights. It just left us there. A third one added. It just drew away and then it disappeared completely from view. What's with this other ship? She didn't pick them up. John's disgust showed in his brow as he looked at Jade's papers. That wasn't normal procedure. Ships didn't drift in ice with engines on standby all night. What was the Californian thinking? Well, that came out in the inquiry, said Jade. Why would Captain Lord do that? Asked Mac. Jade played the rest of the tape, then came a voice, that of a frail-sounding, elderly Englishman who had been one of the surviving crewmen of Titanic. He spoke with a strong, northern English accent and in a strange dialect which Jade and the others found difficult to discern, especially so, given the age of the recording. Oh aye, there were definitely another ship, read enough. We thought she'd come to pick us all up, but she disappeared over TH or isn't as quick as you're like. We never saw her Aegean. Me and me mates in the boat were up and mad about it. The weren't of some cursing going on, even why ladies present and all, I can tell thee, he put forth in a somber tone. And yet another told. Titanic was listing to port. Ruth Blanchard said she saw Titanic break in two. She was 12 at the time. They never believed her either. She stuck to her story. The story is in the survivors. Chapter 20 Morgan's Yacht, 1911 Jack and the old man were at odds, one on each side of the table in the dim light coming through the porthole into the study. The heated argument progressed as Morgan, already down half a bottle of scotch, morbidly went on about the inadequate cash flow. Jack knew finances. He had his own idea of how to save the holdings. Looking at the financial state of the assets, he was irritated and accusing, as he could be. He had to choose. Would he confront the old man now or later? Later was worse. Later meant more time would go by. The severity of the situation would increase. Jack felt pressured. The old man was the epicenter, loud and hard, but Jack had been born into that. He knew he could deal with Morgan. This time he meant to stand his ground. It will take 6 years to get back your initial investment on the ships alone, Jack said. 6 years is nothing. The old man's seasoned voice was as smooth as the scotch he had laced it with. By then we'll own all the lines, said Morgan, as his lips touched the glass, pouring the 24-year-old scotch down his bellowing throat. His hand was fine-tuned to put the crystal exactly to his lips, as it had done thousands of times, over the long years. It was as if it was naturally formed now, to ever so caress the glass for this function. Now are we to pay for a dock as well? Jack stiffened. Anger flowed from Jack like hot coals. He realized how naive he had been in his dealings with the old man. Jack was still at the point he could walk away. He was burned out. Morgan was too much work. I see where the money is going. It's a bad investment. Don't bullshit me. Now you want to pay for the dock, Jack hammered. This was his inheritance. He could see it all squandered in the blink of an eye. As the wrinkles tightened on the old man's face, he knew it would all be his in the next 10 years, if not sooner. His father was overweight and drank and smoked cigars more than any man could survive. Jack knew he would never have to work for a living, but he certainly wasn't about to see loss of the great enterprise being dangled in front of him before he even got his hands on it. It was Prime Holdings, a monopoly on industry. He railed into Margon. You want to dominate transatlantic shipping with your international mercantile marine, but given the interlocking directorates and contractual arrangements with the railroads, the unscheduled nature of sea transport, American antitrust legislation and an agreement with the British government, how the hell are we going to make it through? He watched the old man pour another drink, just ignoring him till it made Jack all the more irritable. The old man hated being confronted. It put him in this sour, agitated mood. He would not take it from anyone. But Jack knew the old man and his flaws, and used it on him. You can only ignore this for so long. These investments, they are not paying off. The ships, they're not in the damn water. The trains are still waiting for all these goddamn passengers to get here. You have Lindbergh breathing down your neck, Jack said as he picked up the paper and read. The partners of J.P. Morgan and Company and directors of First National and National City Bank control aggregate resources of $22 billion. The compared value of all the property is that of the wealth of 20 states west of the Mississippi. He scowled at Morgan and tossed the paper. You know Congressman Lindbergh and Astor are after you. They aren't joking around. They're out for blood. They mean to stop you. Will you stop the damn drinking and listen to me? He grabbed the glass. Do you hear what I'm saying? They mean to stop International Mercantile Marine and its subsidiaries. What protection will we have? Morgan just opened another bottle and filled a clean glass. The scotch didn't console, but it did fire his engines hard. Jack was as stubborn as his father. He fired into the old man. Your idea to combine several major American and British lines is a grand scam. But look at the books. A goddamn floating hotel. It hasn't made a dollar. There is talk of war in Britain. You know that. And you're building a floating hotel. This is going to break us. Just because you live on the high sea. There are rules. There are laws. The old man had no interest in laws. Laws, what do I care? There is no law on the sea. This is where we are and we're not going back, bring his man here. Jack needed to fully comprehend how far Morgan would go to make his empire. Morgan took another drink, full of liquor he could walk through anything. Jack was no match for him. Don't you hear me? You're overspent. You're suffering from inadequate cash flow. There's a default on bond interest payments. You'll need a goddamn war to save you. The old man knew that and a war would serve him well. No one would stop this old man's plans. Astor is getting together with Lindbergh to call for an investigating committee. They want to take you down. They want the records. They want to look into our controlled subsidiary corporations, interlocking directorates, and our contractual arrangements with the railroads. Listen to me, said Jack. Morgan would not give an inch. Damn it, I give up, said Jack. Bring his man here, Morgan said. What could Jack do to get him to listen? He was drained. Morgan had drained everyone around him. Ismay entered. You're certainly a man of wealth and taste. The yacht is magnificent, said Ismay. What's the cost of maintaining such a ship? If you have to ask the price, you can afford it, came Morgan in response. He was not in any mood to be gracious. Ismay glanced at the portrait of Morgan on the wall. This was the only portrait that hadn't had the nose retouched. It showed Morgan in a moment of anger. He kept it in his study, as he said, to scare the shit out of people. It was a decadent reminder to him how fierce he was. Ismay didn't want to face Morgan. He could tell he was in one of those moods where one look would crush you. Morgan had a tremendous physical effect on people. Ismay felt as if a gale had blown through him. Of all days do I meet him so distasteful, or is he just always like this? Ismay thought. Morgan was physically large, with massive shoulders, piercing eyes and a nose purple with flaring up rosacea, which particularly aggravated him these months. The skin disease more than bothered him, it made him ugly. When his nose flamed up, he was impossible to deal with. It bothered him so that he looked like this. It affected all his dealings with a moody temper. Morgan disliked publicity anyway because it was never flattering. It was always about his holdings. Were they legal? He owned half the country according to the article that Jack had read, and the photo stuck in his craw. The old man thought they were out to stop him. He threw the paper down and poured a drink, the bottle now near half empty. Why had that photograph made it in the paper? He was self-consciousness of his nose. He had all of his professional portraits retouched to hide the disfigured clump that was his nose. But the ones in the papers were ones he couldn't retouch. They were there for the world to see the real Morgan. It was something that bitterly destroyed him to the bone. All his wealth couldn't buy him a pretty nose. It appeared as if he dared people to meet him squarely and not shrink from the sight, asserting the force of his character over the ugliness of his face. That photograph of him that Lindbergh and Astor managed to get on the front page, that ugly photo bothered old Morgan more than the headline, Morgan's Interlocking Directorate's Monopoly Investigations Needed. We have lots of work to do, Morgan tried to pull it together. Then there was a knock at the door. Jack and the old man hushed. Jack opened it. Ben entered, holding a telegram. The look on his face told Morgan that it was not going to be good news. You better see this, Mr. Morgan. Nikola Tesla is working on a propulsion system in. Propulsion? What? Snapped Morgan, cutting him off. Yes, said Ben. Tesla? Propulsion? Morgan asked, enraged. Propulsion systems on aircraft, this is the newest technology, said Ben. Astor is backing him. What, giving propulsion to Astor? Morgan fumed. Yes, Mr. Morgan, Tesla. This is the newest technology, replied Ben. Hold on a goddamn minute, Astor is backing him, you said? Morgan was pissed. Yes, Mr. Astor is backing this technology. Hell. Morgan's blood pressure was going like a funnel stack. His mind was cranking. I was backing Tesla. I am at the edge of technology. I own electricity, energy, railroads, shipping. Astor is very interested, said Ben. That bastard. Morgan was frightening the way his eyebrows went up at the ends and frowned down toward the tip of his nose. He used it well to frighten his victims. He wished Astor was there now so he could use it on him. He wanted Astor in front of him now, feeling the pounding strikes of his walking stick. Aster. He's the problem. Morgan clenched his fist, turning his hand white. Hate filled his veins, where blood should have been. His face drained of color. His eyes stared blankly. He looked like a stone wall that was crumbling from years of lashings from wind and time. He's against the banking bill, and now this. Aster, Strauss, Guggenheim and Lindbergh. They're all against me. In Morgan's voice was the refusal to be beaten. His brain was now in overdrive, plotting, planning. Run derogatory articles on Aster, character assassination, scandal pieces, about him and his new bride, that 19-year-old. I want to see it in print. Keep running them till you run out of ink. He divorces his wife and marries a girl. This young girl, young enough to be his daughter. Run his name in the mud, he raged. Jack had never seen him so agitated. There were sides of his father even he did not understand. Competition, rivalry, all must have been in his father's head. Jack needed to observe it all. He needed to understand the old man from all sides. Morgan's business side was the one that Jack now realized was critical to observe. There were many sides to the old man. Jack's challenge was to figure them out. This was a real education for him. There was no better school than the school of Morgan. Jack would take it on, learning from the master that stood before him, brutal and tough, this sly, last decadent of the 19th century. Morgan opened a new box of his Havana cigars dubbed Hercules Clubs. I want to see Aster cringe, said Morgan. Jack saw it had all taken its toll. He feared he too would become the statue of a man. Forget Aster. If we hope to dominate shipping across the Atlantic using linked directorates and contracts with the railroads, you need to stop the American antitrust legislation, he said. There were several model ships all around them. Morgan toyed with one of them, a scale model of his new pride and joy, RMS Olympic. The White Star Line needs to start replaying my investment. Get her full of passengers, make money. That was Morgan's plan. He walked around his models, quietly pleased with himself, and sucked his trademark cigar. The Olympic must bring in revenue. There are millions of immigrants coming over to New York from Europe right now. That's millions of dollars. I want those passengers. I want to see a return. He tipped his cigar ash. It fell as a log into the tray and then cracked into powder. He poured a stiff drink. Get Olympic in the water now, Morgan solidified. He was hard and serious as the words left his mouth. His ventures had not paid off, he could not afford the White Star to be idle. That meant Olympic had to be in service. I don't care if she's not ready. No fanfares, no spectacle, just get her in the water, Morgan declared. Chapter 21 Atlantic Siren, 1993. Masters burst in as Jade surged through the tapes. You're riling up my crew. They want to impress you, and they all want the gold. You see, these goddamn subs are landing on her, doing damage to the deck, stripping her bare. You write that in the goddamn script or I'll find someone who can, he told her. If you want to make some other story, you paid for a ship and come out here on your own dime. Why did you bother to bring me along? She snapped. Get to the crew room. Now. And I want to see that script. He turned swift and left. Jade felt stepped on, her script, the details that should be in this story would be ruined. She wanted to fight for her film, but it wasn't hers. It was Master's and he was going to rewrite it the way he wanted. Jade grabbed her copy of the script and left. Bale met up with him in the office, just off the mess area. Masters stood next to a large composite model of Titanic, constructed as they thought she now lay. It was 18 feet in length and dominated the entire room. "We are going to bring the Ravs, Sinbad and Neptune on the next trip," he told them. "Lighting is key. We need to bring in Nautilus at this angle, like this, otherwise the light is just in our eyes and we won't see at all." Masters held his models, complete with their lights glowing brightly in the darkened room, at the correct angles in order to recreate, as accurately as possible, the expected conditions down on the ocean floor. "Hit the lights," he ordered brusquely, and the room went completely dark except for the tiny lights on the models. "Are we bringing in the chandelier light?" Flynn asked, bringing in the model of the hover light. "Yeah. We'll use it as much as we can for overhead lighting. We'll only be able to see what is lit," Masters replied. In the darkness of the room, the reconstruction of Titanic looked uncannily like the real thing. It was a poignant moment. The whole of the room fell silent. "We never land on the bridge," said Johns, shattering the mood. "You got it," Masters retorted. In the semi-dark, the shadows playing around his face revealed a handsome, but nevertheless hard, man. Masters then proceeded to play a computer recreation of where he believed the most appropriate and convenient opening to be. Everyone was silent. His voice was reassuring but not calming as he rubbed his stubble. His tone completely shifted the mood of the room to one of excitement and expectancy. "We don't know what we'll encounter. We've never done this before. We do a run inside with the bots. Sinbad and Neptune are the main attractions. They can get in there and get the interior. They can get in where no one has been. If the bots can pull this off, we'll have total success," said Masters. He demonstrated the bot camera. Using the remote, the computer screen showed whatever the bot camera pointed at, as it angled its little green eye. The bot was small and agile, with a detached light that rotated to aid the camera. Masters hit some buttons and the computer simulation demonstrated the route the Ravs would explore, deep in Titanic's innards. It had been a long day. They all were grateful when Masters was done. Alarms were set for 5:30 a.m. in preparation for what was hopefully to be a momentous day ahead. Chapter 22. Atlantic Siren, 1993. Masters stood on the bridge, out on the North Atlantic Ocean. He held his head high as he spoke with Captain Densler. He knew time was short. He needed to know the condition of the weather each day of the trip. "Yeah, the weather is holding," said Densler. "I hope it stays as calm. It's not like I can anchor. Hold it steady. I want you to be here when we get back," said Masters. He looked at the group as they gathered on the deck. The morning was still dark as they prepared for their journey into the deep, cold water. He looked hard at Jade, not saying anything, then he walked on down toward them. He just watched her as he moved toward Nemo. He couldn't see her face, but he was drawn to her. He watched her zip up her hoodie, pick up her bag and walk forward to the submersible. He watched the way she walked, the way her hair blew soft in the breeze. There was still much he liked about her and much that he feared. Nemo was wet with the morning mist, waiting there like a cold, barren creature, on the dark deck before her. As Jade moved toward Nemo, she felt Master's eyes watching her. She didn't turn to look, but she could pick up on the piercing energy. This added to the tense morning. Jade was already unsettled and hated the thought of going down, but she was motivated by her interest in all the things she had wanted to know, Her nerves were on edge, and still she knew she must challenge herself. The memory of Nemo's enclosed space was still felt in her bones, but she had to go. The 9 hours it would be before she would see the light of day, or smell the fresh air, wouldn't leave her mind. She felt as the stale lunch they packed her. Thinking about the dangers turned her brain into a virtual realm where everything looked to be in slow motion. She could see her steps moving as if she was not attached to them. She watched as they inched closer to the sub. Must remember to breathe. The sound of her lungs filling with the cold fresh air had a shallow, hollow tunnel whoosh that seemed not connected to her, but brought color to her cheeks. She forced herself to draw in another bellow of air as she took in the morning sky, which in this moment was breathtaking. Pink, orange, light blue and shades, and cotton candy white swirled and filled the sky. This seemed the most beautiful sky she could remember seeing, and it heightened all her senses. The breeze felt chilly before the warmth of any sun had come over the horizon. She looked for Mac, but he was busily getting in the other sub, dealing with his own nerves. She had wanted his warm and confident face to turn to calm her before she entered the ethereal world below. Instead, Masters came up silent behind her to board Nemo. She felt him as he moved close, yet even more distant. The crew went about their tasks quietly but efficiently. They readied the dinghy, and Nemo and Nautilus were fully loaded, ready. As she climbed in for another tedious 3-hour descent ahead of her, Jade felt the powerful arms of Masters at her waist, helping her in. The trip to the ocean floor seemed to take forever. They drifted on down. Jade sucked on lemon slices, toying with them in her lips. She felt his eyes as they stole glances of her. There were things about Masters that seemed hidden. She had the time to think about him as they floated this long time. She sensed there was this kindness that he had somewhere that was rusted up, like Titanic. As if he, too, had been crashed and left as a forgotten relic on the bottom of the sea. She caught herself thinking about him. Why was he interesting to her, his mystery fascinating? As her lips wrapped around the lemon slice, she felt Master's eyes as the stole glances at her. Her lips aimed as innocent as a weapon as they spoke. "You and I both look at life through a lens," she said. Masters watched as her lips gave up the vague tone. They were treacherous in their temptation. "I hired you because I wanted someone who is unknown. Who wouldn't ask a lot of questions. Who came cheap." In the still moment her fate was altered. His cruelty would assure the distance. As he looked up she felt varied. His cruel tongue covered his own vanity that must have held a deep scar. He squelched the attraction her soft eyes held that were wearing him down. Masters had lost even though he had won. His coldness, worn as a weapon, only made him realize his emptiness. She had been stripped bare, with a wound that ran red. Her eyes stared a long moment before she turned away, disgusted. Her hand found the pee jug. She put it next to her as she stood up and unzipped her pants, staring at nothing, caring not at all, every bit as distant as he. There was nothing now more shaming than his tongue. A peak of flesh caught Masters unaware, even before he turned his head. She pulled them down over her hips and then lower. Masters averted his eyes till the jug slid easily between her legs and sound splashed against the plastic. He stole a glance from under his arm at her white thigh skin under her shirt tail, subtle and taunting. John's was silent as it all happened. He had no escape. They came on down now and were close to Titanic. Masters hit the lights. "Lights on."
"Copy," said Masters.
"Lights," said Flynn.
"We're here."
They went further now, nearing the stern. Out in the sand, lying useless were parts of the ship.
There are the cargo cranes right there, see that? Said Masters.
That's what they would have lifted the gold with, said Johns.
How did they get there?
The light panned over more debris.
That looks like a piece of the double bottom, said Masters.
How did those two pieces of keel detach? Asked Johns.
Why didn't they land over here in the stern debris?
Hydrodynamic flow.
Forensics, huh?
Hydrodynamic flow can't explain all this damage, questioned Johns.
But Masters had a way of always getting the last word.
There are the boilers.
We're getting close, said Masters.
If she broke in the middle, they could be from boiler room 1.
Something put those boilers on the seafloor.
The breakup that took place is massive, like a bomb hit it there.
I think they fell off in the descent.
They got closer and finally saw the body of the stern, or what was left of it.
The sight was daunting as Johns looked in disbelief.
I just didn't think it could be this bad, said Johns as he saw the wreck of the stern.
It looks like the force of the water blew the poop deck back over on itself, Masters claimed.
You're proposing that the stern deck folded over itself by water force when she tore apart?
I disagree.
It doesn't make sense, said Johns. It would take a lot more than that to pull that steel up and over.
No, no, no. I just don't think anything short of an explosion could do this.
Something big hit this area.
It's mysterious, said Masters.
If they put the gold in the stern cargo hold, and we don't know how much gold we're talking about here.
If the gold is in there, it will be a hell of a time getting it out.
Maybe impossible, said Johns.
The floors are pancaked.
Many strange-looking, unknown sea creatures moved along the boat deck floor, disturbing the sand with their snouts as they went, occasionally pausing to devour some piece of bioflotsam or other, smaller, apeless creatures, as they went across the deck, disappearing in the portholes, bothered by the subs.
Nemo's on the topside run bow starboard side, Masters confirmed into the microphone.
Nautilus, mark your position. Came Dudley on the radio.
Look at that.
More damage from subs landing here on the boat deck.
They really broke the shit out of it, came Danny's voice over the intercom from Nautilus.
He was telling Mac, we're right on top, so close to the deck you can actually see the damage these subs do, landing on her.
It just caves it in, sinks the whole deck in.
Danny leaned to the mic.
You seeing this?
There's some serious damage there.
Yeah, said Masters.
Captain's quarters starboard view, Flynn told Mac.
Nautilus is on the bow topside boat deck run, over, Flynn radioed back to Nemo.
Executing cameras, Masters announced.
Nautilus moved farther along the boat deck following Nemo. The boat deck was where the wheelhouse, the navigating bridge and the captain's quarters were.
Masters continued to take photos with the exterior camera, putting them up on the computer. Then he made a freeze frame to compare with how this area of the ship had looked originally. The freeze frame turned into a graphic on the screen and then merged into the computerized blueprint of the hull. This assisted them in locating precisely where they were on Titanic's giant frame.
Masters knew Titanic, but it was easy to get lost on her, covered in years of sand and rust equals in the new position of things since the wreck. It was surprising he could make out as much as he could. He seemed to have an internal sense of direction, but, without the computer to verify, even Masters could end up lost down here in the dark. Even with all their lights, it was dark and moody.
Nautilus moved farther along the boat deck, following Nemo. The boat deck was where the chart room and the pilot quarters were, behind the wheelhouse.
Then they veered a bit starboard to the captain's quarters. Then suddenly, Nemo's green lights revealed the first-class promenade deck in all its glory. Jade imagined it in its bump with all Titanic's first-class passengers strolling about, making small talk and offering pleasantries to their fellow travelers as they passed the time of day, counting the hours until they reached their destination of New York. She imagined it the way she had read about it and from the pictures she had seen of Olympic. She had read about Captain Smith. She thought, he'd have walked right there mingling with the first class. His reputation as a witty old charmer had seduced a myriad of passengers. She knew Bruce Ismay, the director of Titanic, would have walked this deck too. He was the one who had survived, so some say, by dressing as a woman and jumping into a lifeboat. He would have been on this deck stepping off into a lifeboat, she thought. He never lived down the embarrassment of having survived when so many women and children perished. The distinguished John Jacob Astor and his bride Madeline were the richest couple aboard, perhaps the richest couple in the world. They had the most prominent staterooms. They would have walked this deck flaunting Madeline's diamonds and furs and stood gazing out across the sea to their New York destination. Madeline Astor walked this deck and was one of the ones who survived, she thought. Flynn pushed some more buttons and Neptune now emerged, released from its confines within the womb of Nautilus. Danny drove her. Neptune is leashed. She's got your tail, Flynn confirmed. Master sent Sinbad in. Neptune followed. The lights gave an eerie glow to the dark way ahead as they combed over the officer's promenade deck, still intact. They passed by the window to the officer's area, just off the bridge. Holy shit. That's the officer's smoking room? Asked Johns, excited. Can you get in there? I can get in there, said Masters. Masters deftly maneuvered Sinbad through it. It was always risky sending the ROVs through tiny gaps, with lethal broken glass or jagged metal edges that could rip the robot control cables. These bots were key to the trip, the only way inside. And anything that cuts that tether would cause them to lose the bot altogether. These were expensive, specially built, delicate units that needed to be cared for. Watch it. You mess up Greg's bot, it comes out of your pay. Joked Danny. Bring the lights around now, ordered Masters. Flynn, behind them, spotted a frightening sight in Nemo's blind spot. Unbeknownst to Johns, he had steered her perilously under some broken piping protruding from Titanic's superstructure, which was invisible from John's angle. It jabbed out towards Nemo and was about to collide with it, threatening to puncture the top of the little sub. Stop. Stop. You're going to hit. Flynn's frantic voice was heard over the intercom from Nautilus. Watch it. Watch it. You got a pipe right above you. Copy. Flynn's alarm stopped Nemo. But it still drifted into the mangled pipe dangling over the little craft. The jagged twisted pipes were too close to Nemo. Masters could hear it scrape the top. He cringed. Jade's face said it all. The situation was bad. Sheer horror gripped her. The scraping sound of the metal shearing the top of Nemo was loud in her head. It was the only thing she could hear. Screech. The sound was a horrid rip or tear. They couldn't tell. Metal was bending. Cutting. The sound was not what you wanted to be hearing at 2 miles down. It was metal being sheared off. Coming through the hull of Nemo's echo was terrifying. Is this what the passengers that didn't make it out heard? It was like something Jade had heard in a film where they were trying to scare the daylights out of you. Only it was real. They're on the other side of the wall or miles of sea waiting to give them a final ending that would equal all great endings. Jade couldn't bear to think about the water rushing in. If that would happen, she remembered, it would implode. Her thoughts going through her head right now would be her last. She had signed the little book that told everyone she was down here. She had agreed to go, but she didn't want to die. Death was too permanent. Who would care anyway? Her life would be over and for what? If she ever made it out of here, she would hope to tell how it felt and how it must have felt for the passengers of Titanic. That was always glossed over, she thought. But the fear she felt now must have been in all the faces of those who didn't make it to the lifeboats. Those souls who watched the sea freeze up their muscles, their bodies not able to function, ending their lives in a way they had never envisioned. Don't think about